This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Let's check in at the State House and take a look at some of the latest stories that have come out from Dan Carton, who's the State House reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And as always, Dan, thanks for joining us here on the program today.
Happy to be here.
Well, first off, let's get started here with the big story of this, probably of the week or maybe even the month here, aside from the elections. It's involving Attorney General Curtis Hill. It's just kind of a continuation of the story that we've had on before about the allegations of inappropriately touching women, including one of our own state representatives. And he, I guess, was part of the investigation here. Tell us what came out when the special prosecutor finally had his report ready.
Sure. So after the allegations came out, the governor and the legislative leaders asked the inspector general, the state's inspector general, to investigate this. Inspector General Lori Torres and her investigators have spent the past 3 months interviewing 56 witnesses, trying to find out exactly what went on that night at AJ's Lounge in Indianapolis. And they ultimately came out with a report Tuesday that they forwarded to the special prosecutor who was appointed in this case. Special prosecutor prepared his own analysis and ultimately decided that he would not charge Curtis Hill with a crime because while the special prosecutor said he believed the women's stories about what happened that night, he contends that it didn't rise to the level of either a misdemeanor or felony crime that would be prosecutable in a way that could result in a conviction.
Mm-hmm. Now, he's certainly far from being out of the woods, though. We know that, if the legislature, when they get together here in January, decides, and we've already, I know you've already talked with enough lawmakers, there are enough state legislative officials who are not happy with how this has all turned out to begin with, I imagine.
Right, and these are Curtis Hill's fellow Republicans. Governor Holcomb has called for Curtis Hill to resign. The Speaker of the House, Brian Bosma, another Republican, has called for Curtis Hill to resign, and Senate President David Long also has called for Curtis Hill to resign. Bosma and Long actually put out a statement saying that if Curtis Hill was their employee, he would have been fired long ago. So it's unclear how far into the legislature the support goes for removing Curtis Hill. I think a lot of people were just hoping he would resign and go away. That's kind of what happens when people in the General Assembly screw up in a variety of ways. But Curtis Hill has shown no signs of going anywhere. He continues to say he did nothing wrong. He's insisted that he's not going to resign. So, push may come to shove. I don't know how you go out as a legislative leader on this ledge and call for this guy's resignation and then just stand by and do nothing for 2 more years while he continues to, file lawsuits and file amicus briefs at the Supreme Court, all in the state of Indiana. This guy you think shouldn't be in office.
I also know, too, that besides the big announcement from Special Prosecutor Dan Siegler that you covered there at the State House this week, and you've got some information, too, from the Indiana Inspector General Lori Torres in her report for the time that she spent on this, too. She went into some great detail, and you had an update as well, too, I guess, about what the Inspector General's report was all about. And I think it was interesting to read, I guess, more of the details of the incident itself that seems to have gotten so much prominent attention earlier this year. And that was was after, I guess, the legislative session ended, did it not?
Yeah, it was. So after the General Assembly ended for the year, I guess it was technically on March 15th, shortly after midnight, this is a tradition among some legislators and lobbyists to go out to a bar and sort of celebrate the end of the session. Us poor reporters are stuck writing about what happened in the last hours of the session, so I've never actually been to a sine die party here in Indiana. From the Inspector General's report, it seems like it was there was a lot of free alcohol and a lot of people making some bad choices that night. Including Curtis Hill, who the report suggested a lot of people were surprised to see him because statewide elected officials don't usually go to this party.
I mean,
he runs his own agency. He's not part of the legislature. It's Several people said how weird it was to see him there. Apparently, according to the report, he was brought there by a lobbyist who he had gone out earlier that night to two different Indianapolis restaurants, and they were drinking wine together. And then he, Curtis Hill, had several more drinks at the bar where this party was happening, and quite a few people at this party suggested that Curtis Hill was drunk at the time that he was getting handsy, allegedly.
I noted here that you had your story here about in the Inspector General's report that one of the witnesses had told her that Mr. Hill was acting like a freshman at a college frat party. That's almost like I guess thinking of Brett Kavanaugh in a way.
That wouldn't be the first time the two have been compared.
Yeah.
And one of the thing, you know, and then in that condition, he was going up to people and talking to them. According to the Inspector General, he went up to Representative Reardon and pretended like he couldn't hear her, so he put his hand on her back and then slid his hand down her back and grabbed her butt, according to the report. He also rubbed the backs or grabbed the butts of several other women. Put his arms over a couple of female lobbyists in a way that made them feel uncomfortable. The description of what he did that night does seem to match the idea of acting like a freshman at a college frat party.
Yeah. We have mentioned that in our stories, and you have, of course, too, in the Times, about the fact that even though Curtis Hill may be not criminally involved, at least he won't be charged criminally, at least, doesn't mean he's not going to end up in court sometime. I'm sure that the tort claims will get filed very soon if they haven't already.
Yeah, the four women, Representative Reardon, who's a Democrat, there's a Senate Democratic staffer, a House Democratic staffer, and a Senate Republican staffer, so... Curtis Hill was allegedly very bipartisan in who he was hanging out with that night, have filed the notices that are required before you can file a civil lawsuit. So they're setting the groundwork to potentially seek monetary damages from him or the state based on his behavior that night.
We're talking with Dan Carton, who's the State House reporter and covers state politics, too, for the Times of Northwest Indiana when it's involved in Indianapolis, like the legislature. And also, there's some other issues, too, that could come up from time to time that because it's state office holders or state office organizations that are involved. One you have in there recently here is talking about, and we've had the stories as well, too, involving organizations here and governmental agencies here in Lake County having come up for audits before the Indiana State Board of Accounts. And it seems like Lake County is having their share of problems in that respect. And you also mentioned, too, that some of the issues may end up, I'm sure, in some way getting addressed by the legislature.
Yeah. The State Board of Accounts does regular audits of every local government in the state. It catches a lot of problems before they become massive problems. They uncover stolen money. I'm originally from Illinois, and they don't do that in Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very surprised to see it here, and it's kind of a hallmark of good government that local governments, you know, somebody's checking up on them to make sure that they're following the rules that are set out in state law. Lake County, the State Board of Accounts released its audit of Lake County recently, and it found that there were quite a few things that the county has been doing wrong over an extended period of time that they've been dinged for in prior audits that they got hit for again in this audit. My story was about a 2017 law that the General Assembly approved that's now in effect that kind of puts some teeth in the audit process. So before the State Board of Accounts would put out an audit, the people responsible would say, oh, yeah, we're going to fix that, and nothing would get done, which if you read this Lake County audit, that's what's been happening in the county. Some of these things have gone unfixed for more than a decade. But this law requires the responsible office holder to submit a corrective action plan to the State Board of Accounts, and if the plan isn't implemented or carried out within 6 months, then the State Board of Accounts has a bunch of tools that they can use to try and force the local government to comply with the state regulations, including, you know, having them making the office holder come down to the state house and explain to the legislature why they're not following the rules, or they could, you know, go so far as to refer the matter to the county prosecutor for potential criminal charges.
I know that this was, I guess, the effort, or this law that is in effect now that came from 2017 is, by the way, if you want to look it up, you can go back and look it up, a House Enrolled Act 1031. It's actually a measure that some Northwest Indiana lawmakers enacted, or I should say originated, and they've helped enact it.
Yeah, State Representative Hal Slager, a Republican from Schererville, was the primary sponsor of the measure, along with Senator Rick Niemeyer, a Republican from Lowell. You know, when I was writing the story, I was trying to remember if they told me that it was because of Lake County that they were doing it. I couldn't find anything about that in my notes, and I wasn't able to reach them. But It's you know, there are a few local government agencies in Northwest Indiana that tend to have repeating problems with getting their audits fixed or correcting audit findings, and that's what drew their attention to this issue. And obviously, given the audit provided by the State Board of Accounts, Lake County is one of them that has repeated audit findings year after year after year.
I know that it's not covered in your story, but I'm sure that probably since you've kept up with what's happened, of course, in Gary in particular, the problems in City Hall, the problems with the Gary Community School Corporation and former executives of the school district, the audits that have come up there too, even though I'm sure they probably are not involved, of course, in your story, but I'm sure they will probably come under this as well. And if things aren't corrected, they'll probably get the same warning, so to speak, I guess, like getting stopped for a traffic violation.
Right. And the legislature is, they did pass this law to put the teeth in this. So, I mean, they are serious about it. Representative Slager initially wanted to deny state budget approval, so these local governments would have been cut off of all funds until they got their financial house in order, and the rest of the General Assembly didn't want to go along with that, or wasn't willing to go that far, but it does seem like the state is really, you know, putting the screws to the locals to say, look, you know, we're not going to keep telling you that you've got this problem with your finances or how you're doing this or that you're not filling out the right forms. You just need to do it and follow our rules.
We're talking with Dan Carden with the Times of Northwest Indiana about the stories that he's had in print as well as online. And one other story, too, that's come up is following up on a local issue that happened years ago in the community of Munster in the school district. And the Indiana Attorney General has been trying to, stay on top of this, and he's gotten some support now to, or at least to, if he gets what he wants from the Indiana Court of Appeals, to get some support on a ruling that's been made locally and trying to get it changed. Tell us about how it involves not only the state, but also the school town of Munster.
Yeah, so two former superintendents in Munster had a kind of a unique contract provision that they ended up getting a lot more salary or a supplement to their salary than supposedly anybody expected, and the Attorney General believes it was an illegal amount. The question is, this all went down in the early 2000s, and technically there's a five-year statute of limitations. Judge McDermott on the Lake Circuit Court said that the Attorney General attempting to get this money back from these former superintendents was outside the statute of limitations, and she effectively threw out his case. The Attorney General has now asked the Indiana Court of Appeals to allow him to pursue this money that he claims was excessively paid to these superintendents on the argument that his office wasn't notified about the potential illegality of it until 2016. So when they started going after the money in 2017, it was well within the five-year statute of limitations. And, now it'll be up to the court to decide who is right.
there's probably no real indication of how long it's going to take for this matter to work its way through the Indiana Court of Appeals, but I would imagine that we probably will get some word back here, I would think, in a few months, shouldn't we?
Yeah, so the superintendents now have a chance to respond to the Attorney General's filing, and then the Court of Appeals is usually acts pretty quickly, so I would imagine probably February or March before we'd get a ruling then.
Well, we'll have another story to be able to talk about at that time, I suppose, too. Dan Carton with the Times Northwest Indiana, as always, thank you for joining us today, and we'll have you back on again real soon.
Anytime.
This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Let's find out what's happening over in LaPorte County, and in particular in Michigan City area. And for that, we are turning to Kelly Smith, who's with the Michigan City News-Dispatch and the LaPorte Herald-Argus. Kelly, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, some really good news for folks who are concerned about whether Michigan City is on the right track as far as planning for the future is concerned. We've got a 20-year comprehensive plan that is very, very close to being approved. Tell us more about that.
Absolutely. So in May of last year, the City of Michigan City contracted with Kendig Keese Collaborative, their consulting firm, that kind of put together a 20-year comprehensive plan for the city. It's called Momentum Michigan City 2040.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of accounts for what they project to be an increase in population of about 10,000 people that they believe will happen because of the double tracking of the South Shoreline, the new Franciscan Hospital campus down there on the south end off of I-94.
Yeah.
And then there are a couple other things that they feel will be moving people into the city. And so they want to be able to accommodate the larger population. So they came up with this plan. They started May of 2017, and they finished it up. It was based largely on public input. They had a lot of different, like, workshops with the city council and the redevelopment commission and the plan commission, and obviously, they work with city officials like Craig Phillips. He's our city planning director. They worked closely with him on this and took into account all of the other smaller plans for the city that have been developed and kind of put into action over the last 10 to 15 years. So things that we've already been talking about, like
there are a lot of things. So obviously, these are supposed to be documents that are not engraved in stone. Any good plan, any good comprehensive plan, is supposed to be very fluid. Have things noted out. Of course, you have to be very careful about this, but you have to be able to kind of work with things. If things change, you have to be able to adjust to them too. So I know that there are all kinds of things that get brought up here. And there's some principal focus areas. Take a minute and tell us how those are kind of broken out and how they are fitting in with this this final draft of the plan that's coming up.
Okay, so there are, in the plan, they broke it down. It's really easy to read, and it's up online, I should say, too.
Oh, yeah.
Anybody could read this and follow along or kind of get your own feel for it, but it's up online at mc2040.com, I believe is the name of the website.
Yeah, right.
But they broke it up into 8 principal focus areas with 1 or 2 goals for each of those areas, and then a whole list of different strategies for reaching those goals.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The strategies are very important, too. There are only 10 of them, but they've got them all well laid out here, because that's all part of it, too, I understand.
Yes. Well, I think there were something like 12 goals and some accompanying objectives and things like that. So there are actually several hundred smaller strategies presented in this overall plan for getting the city where they want it to go. And Aaron Tooley is the consultant from Kendig Keese Collaborative who presented this to the Plan Commission on, I want to say it was Monday of last week.
Yeah.
And he made sure to specify that this is, like you said, fluid. It's flexible. It's all based on projections in population growth and projections and events that are going to happen, or, you know, that we anticipate will happen here.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, should those things go differently, then the plan adjusts take that into account.
And we should also remind listeners, too, that if you want to check out more information about this this final draft of the 2040 plan for Michigan City, it's mc2040.com. And yeah. You're going to find all the information there that you have, too. One of the other stories, too, I know, Kelly, that you worked on is a very interesting one. It's election-related, and it actually it's television and election-related. Tell us tell us where Rati Gupta comes into all this.
Well, Rati, I feel like I'm name-dropping. She and I grew up next door to each other when we were small. And so it was really cool to be asked to write this story. I was like, I know her from, 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. So she is a Michigan City native. She is from here. She graduated in 2002 from Marquette High School. I think she was salutatorian, super smart. And she went off to, I believe, Northwestern and studied dance and eventually moved out to L.A. and broke into the entertainment industry. And I know she studied dance, but she wound up doing comedy. So I know that people here are kind of familiar with her. She did a one-woman comedy show called Not Another Teen Solo Show. She was in an MTV movie a few years back called Worst Prom Ever. I believe she's got a recurring role in Seth Rogen's upcoming Future Man, which comes out in 2019.
Wow.
She's a voice character. Uh-huh. But recently she has been on The Big Bang Theory, which is, a huge show.
Oh, yeah, huge.
Everyone knows the show. And this is their final season. And so she's been cast as, I believe the character's name is Anu. She's Raj's fiance. Mm-hmm. She should be on the air in tonight's Halloween episode.
Oh, so. Really? Wow. Yeah. Okay, I have to catch that to be sure. Well, I know that, and she's also very, very closely involved in things that are involved with politics and related. Yeah. Tell us more from what you've learned about this organization called Five Calls.
Yes. So, and I've seen her posting about this, actually, on her social media for the last, the better part of 2 years, I would say, at least. Mm-hmm. And so she's still very heavily involved. She said she wasn't so involved in politics before the 2016 general election, but she said it felt like such a momentous occasion, like in the country's history. She just felt the need to get involved. And so she reached out to the founders of the website and a mobile app, and it's called Five Calls. And she reached out to them and asked if they could use any help, and they gave her everything that she could handle. So she's in charge of driving content, and she has a lot of responsibilities with that. It's a volunteer thing, but anybody can access Five Calls. I'm looking up the site now. You can go to your app store on your phone and type in Five Calls, but it's the objective of using the app or of accessing the website is to put constituents in better contact with not only their representatives, but with the issues that are moving through Congress. Because watching the news or listening to the news or reading the news doesn't always feel like you get the comprehensive feel for what's going on. You might get, this person's opinion on what's happening. But if you want to know exactly what's in Congress right now and exactly, what that means, they are able to provide you with that. They do also provide you with representatives, like your senator or your representative, their contact information. And if you're not sure what to say, they also have scripts kind of ready for you to, you can either read or write them verbatim, or you can just kind of use them for ideas Well, I identify with this perspective, and this is what I would like to say to this representative so they know.
I know you mentioned in your story about the fact that she came back to Michigan City. I think she came back, I guess, earlier because she wanted to be involved. I'm sure to see family members and friends as well. But tell us what she was doing back here and how that's kind of gone along with what she's gotten involved in out in Los Angeles.
Absolutely. So, Rati had kind of a scheduling shift for filming with The Big Bang Theory, and she found that she had about a week of time to herself and felt it would be a good time. She wanted to come home before the election and felt like this would be a really good week to do that. So she came, she attended the Friday night, so it would have been almost 2 weeks ago now, that the Friday night rally for Senator Joe Donnelly, I believe it was in Hammond.
Yeah, that's right.
Joe Biden was there. Pete Buczkowski was there. Some celebrities, some politicians. And she went and she said she just felt, you know, really inspired and encouraged and kind of pumped up to be out there. So the next morning, Saturday morning, she and a friend from Marquette, they went to high school together, they went to Senator Donnelly's field office here in Michigan City to pick up some volunteer packets. They felt inspired to get out and kind of canvass neighborhoods and talk to constituents about, you know, what their concerns are. And so that's what they did. They did it on Saturday. And she said she had no intention of, or she wasn't expecting to, you know, meet the senator. But when she went to pick up her packet, not only was Senator Joe Donnelly there, so was Senator Chris Coons. And he actually recognized her.
He recognized her from the TV show. Yeah,
that's yeah, he's a big for his daughter.
He's a big fan too. That's great. Yeah. So, well, what a great way to be able to not only get involved certainly with the campaign, even though that she's, you know, got, I guess, two residences in a way. She's got Michigan City and of course Los Angeles, where she stays when she's out there as an actor and in other events. But she was able to get involved back here in Northwest Indiana. It was very interesting. Mm-hmm. And people can check out the story in the News Dispatch about this too. And mm-hmm. and one other item that we wanted to bring up here, we have a chance to talk, Kelly, is another story, and maybe you can give us an update as well, too. A couple of LaPorte County Sheriff's deputies unfortunately got attacked while they were at the Michigan City Courthouse. Tell us how that all happened and how these deputies are doing it at last report.
Oh, yes. Okay. So that one was more recent. I believe it was last Friday that mm-hmm. that happened. At the Michigan City Courthouse, if you've ever been in there, when you come in that door off of Washington Street, the first thing after the double doors that you'll be greeted by is a metal detector. And mm-hmm. at the metal detector, they man that with sheriff's deputies who are working security there to make sure that, you know, no firearms or anything else, no cell phones, no anything you're not supposed to have in the courthouse. They're there to make sure that doesn't happen. Well, apparently, they were just there doing their jobs on Friday of last week. When a man ran into the courthouse, he wasn't armed, he wasn't wearing a shirt, he just ran in and sucker punched Deputy, I believe, John Keene, injured his nose pretty badly.
Yeah.
And another deputy came to help, and that deputy wound up sustaining some injuries to his arm, minor injuries, abrasions, things like that. But this man was kind of volatile and aggressive and hostile, and they really weren't sure what was wrong with him, but they wound up tasing him and handcuffing him with the assistance of Michigan City police officers and got him transported to the jail.
Well, now he gets to spend time in jail, and he gets to show up before the judge in the courthouse later, and he's facing, what, battery against a public safety officer, I guess, is what the charge is. Any word as to when he is supposed to appear in court, or has he made his initial appearance yet?
He did. He made his initial appearance on Tuesday, actually.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I can't tell you off the top of my head what happened with that one.
But I'm sure, he'll be back. He'll be back in for more formal hearings, to be sure. And I'm sure that, you know, he's probably been already, if he hadn't already picked somebody, he's probably been assigned an attorney to help him on the case there, to be sure. So he'll be back dealing with this for, I'm sure, some time. And I guess they're probably still looking into why he got so upset that prompted him to rush into the courthouse and cause the incident to begin with.
So Chief Deputy Ron Heeg of the LaPorte County Sheriff's Office, I talked to him that day, later that afternoon, and that's what he said, that there was something obviously wrong.
Yeah.
You know, it's not every day somebody comes in, you know, not wearing a shirt and just bum rushes an officer. So they're trying to determine a motive. They don't really need to determine any facts around what happened. They understand the circumstances, and they're all on the courthouse cameras. So they don't have any questions about what happened. They're trying to determine why it happened.
Yeah.
But 37-year-old Joshua Duncan, I believe is his name, 37-year-old Josh Duncan was booked at the LaPorte County Jail. He got like a $15,000 bond. And if he, at his initial hearing on Tuesday, if he would have requested a public defender at that time, the judge would have then, you know, done the, like the survey to make sure that he qualified and appointed one if necessary. But I can't say whether or not that happened.
Well, we're sure to find out. This is one of these stories that I guess you can say stay tuned to, because I'm sure you'll have updates later. Kelly Smith is a reporter with the Michigan City News-Dispatch, and of course, it's part of the LaPorte Herald Argus chain of papers there in Northwest Indiana. And Kelly, thank you for spending time with us today on the program to talk about the stories that you've had online and in print already out there, and we'll look for more later. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Let's revisit a conversation that we had back in July with IU Northwest economics professor Micah Pollack. He was on the program to talk about the impact of tariffs here in Northwest Indiana. And here's the conversation. The Trump administration has now seen the first of the series of tariffs issued on some $34 billion in Chinese goods here in the country. It's, of course, part of the escalating war, so to speak, as some are calling it, by the United States on several countries that experts say might have an impact even here in Northwest Indiana, not only on jobs, but also on how much we pay for products. We find out more from Indiana University economics professor Micah Pollack, who joined with some of his colleagues elsewhere in the recent article in the Post Tribune about the impact that Northwest Indiana could share with others involving the impact of the tariffs. And Micah, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I know that the big question, I guess, is with not only what we're going to face as far as the taxes are concerned, that the businesses are going to be stuck with here with the tariffs, but also, I guess, it comes down to about the job situation. I know that you had spent time in talking with Karen Caffarini with the Post Tribune about this for her article recently. Tell us what you see are going to be some of the winners and some of the losers as this this war involving us and the tariffs are going on.
Yeah, absolutely. So, a trade war is ultimately about forcing everyone to suffer in an attempt to punish someone. And so as a result, there's often not a lot of winners if things continue to escalate. But you would think that an obvious winner might be the steel industry, in which, you know, presumably with less, you know, competition from abroad, they would see an increase in production, and therefore that we'd have more jobs created in the steel industry. But that's not necessarily the case, because, as price goes up, that means now that people want to buy a good will go down. So you may see fewer construction projects, fewer decreased demand for steel, certainly internationally from the U.S. And so kind of one of the common winners may not be such a large winner. And then, of course, the really big downside is all these other industries that are going to be negatively affected, especially, you know, the soybean industry. More than a third of our soybeans are exported to China. And, you know, if we lose that market, a lot of farmers here in the area are going to be hurting.
I know that the first round of matters in this warrant with the tariffs came across here because of the imported steel and aluminum that was coming from China and the impact it was having on our domestic markets here. And I know that that companies like U.S. Steel and I suppose, too, for a lesser extent, like ArcelorMittal, were probably seeing some benefit from this. But we know that's very swiftly turned around, hasn't it?
Yeah. So a tariff is kind of a very blunt instrument, and it works well as a threat. But if you actually have to follow through on the threat, often it's not as effective. Ultimately, our economy is very interconnected, and you don't want to have to make all the other industries suffer in order to try to get a small improvement in one industry. That's kind of what we've fallen into here. We're entered kind of a war of attrition now, where the only way to win is to really just suffer economically the longest at this point.
Mm-hmm. And we know that the things have changed now, if going from China now to Europe, to Canada, to Mexico, with the products that are coming in across the borders from those countries and from Europe, I guess, the number of countries in the EU that are now facing the impact of the Trump administration tariffs. What have you seen so far in talking with your colleagues about, the impact with these retaliatory tariffs that have been imposed now?
Sure. So a lot of times the consequences are kind of unexpected. One example I can point to is, the Harley-Davidson situation, where in response to these tariffs, they're actually going to reduce some of their production in the United States and shift it overseas in order to avoid the tariffs. And so even though you think that it might be beneficial for an industry like this, sometimes it's better to cut their losses and completely shift their production away rather than be subject to the tariffs.
You also mentioned, too, not only do we have the issues involving steels and all sorts of other items like that, but we have the impact on agricultural products. And I guess that's what we're now starting to face now, too, aren't we, with the impact on soybeans and I'm sure probably even eventually corn that goes overseas, too.
Absolutely. And you have to remember that a tariff is just a fancy name for a tax on foreign goods. And any kind of tax, regardless of who you impose it on, in the end, ultimately gets paid by different people. So even though we're imposing a tax on these foreign goods, in the end, as a consumer, you end up paying a higher price as a result of that tax. So in many ways, the tariff is really a tax on us as U.S. consumers as well. So that means higher prices for any good that comes from overseas or has any part of the process happening overseas or uses any input that comes from overseas as well. So it can really affect a lot of goods here in Northwest Indiana, the types of goods we buy all the time.
What have you noted that we've started to see already and the impact on the soybean market in particular here, since that seems to be the commodity that seems to be watched closely now because it comes mostly in large part from Indiana and is going overseas to places primarily like China?
Yeah, so I think there's some long-term consequences that haven't really been thought through yet. I mean, one of the reasons we're in this kind of trade situation with China in the first place is because they subsidize the steel industry quite heavily. Well, with these tariffs on soybeans, now, of course, China still needs to purchase soybeans, and so they're increasing the subsidies they provide to their own farmers to create soybeans. So in the long run, we may see a shift away from demand for soybeans from China as they become more kind of dependent on their own soybean production.
Mm-hmm. Is this starting, as you can tell so far, any real impact on Hoosier farmers, or is that going to come down the road?
I think there's still too much uncertainty to know what impact is going to happen. You certainly see some kind of price jitters going on. But, you know, it's going to be kind of a long time for all this to get sorted out and kind of see what the bottom line is. And and you may see prices decreasing for soybeans quite substantially as the demand, you know, from overseas is not there. Although, you know, perhaps some other countries will take an opportunity to, you know, buy up some cheap American soybeans as well.
Now, we're talking about primarily the impact so far in this trade war with the tariffs involving the Trump administration and overseas markets. Primarily China, but it's now branching out to not only Canada and Mexico, but also into Europe as well. Or as we see the impact start to fold into what we're paying for these goods coming in from overseas and the extra taxes, as you mentioned, what kind of impact are we starting to see or are we likely to see in the near future as well as long term in how jobs are going to be faced with this situation with this expense here in Northwest Indiana?
Yeah, so from the perspective of a firm, particularly a production firm, they're going to kind of get hit on both sides of this because on one hand, the cost of their production is going to go up as the inputs that they purchase potentially from overseas or the machinery they need or the components they need get more expensive. And then on the other side, the tariffs essentially create barriers to trading with other countries. And so the international demand for their goods is going to decline. And so you're going to really see, you know, firms being squeezed and producers being squeezed. And I think soybeans is going to be one of the kind of leading cases that kind of get hit the hardest first. But, you know, eventually, you know, our international economy is so interconnected and so interdependent that it's hard to trace, you know, the production of one particular good from just one country. And so, you know, any particular good will go through many, many countries. And if you're hit by tariffs every time you cross the border, then that's going to increase your cost of production substantially.
We're talking with IU Northwest economist Micah Pollack about the impact that we here in Northwest Indiana are likely to face here, not only in jobs, but also in markets as the Trump administration continues the war on trade and assessing and being turned in retaliation, being assessed with higher taxes, the tariffs on not only steel and aluminum, but also the other goods, the consumer goods, I guess, too. When you think about it from China, we buy an awful lot of consumer goods or things that go into what's made here in the United States that comes listed in parts or at least components from China, don't we?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think you can pick up any good that you've purchased in some point in the process. Some of it came through China. It was assembled in part in China or includes components from China at some point. And so anything that, you know, comes through China, potentially, if the trade war continues to escalate, will have an added cost added on to you as the final consumer.
And I would imagine, too, that there are a number of companies and industries, too, that that depend so much on trade from China. I can just think of, just for example, the discount stores, not only getting things that are directly made in China and they're shipped here and sold here in the United States, but as you say, those parts that happened, maybe if they happened across from U.S. into China to be made, we come back and we find the extra tax there, too, I imagine.
Yeah, and there's not necessarily a lot of margin for profit on stores like that, so they may struggle. As well as, you know, we are a major transportation hub for international trade here with, you know, the ports and the interstates that we have. And so, you know, if international trade declines, we may see a lot of reductions in logistics employment and shipping employment and things like that as well.
I know that the information that was in Karen Caffarini's article in the Post-Tribune talks about from the standpoint of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce that on their website they were saying at one point that about $1 billion in Indiana exports might be threatened by the tariffs. And then they were also estimating about 812,000 Hoosier jobs are supported by global trade. So we're probably going to see an impact there, too. What rough figures would you say we might face here as far as job losses here in Northwest Indiana if things continue the way they're continuing?
I mean, right now it sounds like things are escalating and, you know, we're going to have another round of tariffs substantially bigger, and that is likely to be responded with tariffs from both the EU and China as well. And so it really depends how much it escalates here, but it is potentially very catastrophic for much of our industry in the United States. Again, the economy doesn't exist within country lines anymore. Now the modern economy is connected between all countries, and you know, a U.S. company may have production facilities outside the U.S. and rely on other companies that are located outside the U.S., and so it's far more complicated than it was in, say, the 60s and 70s.
Now, Micah, what do you think can be done, at least as far as Northwest Indiana industries, businesses, and the like are concerned, to be able to fight this off, if there's anything that can be done? Is there something we can be done to be able to keep the jobs that that seem to be threatened by all of this?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough question here. As long as the tariffs continue to be enacted and expanded, it's going to be very difficult, especially in industries like farming and soybeans, where you don't necessarily have a lot of room to make big adjustments overnight. Mm-hmm. I mean, long term, you're going to have to look for other sources for your input, maybe establish new relationships with other countries you haven't traded with as much. But ultimately, you know, that may depend on what type of tariffs get imposed on other countries in the future as well.
Are we finding there's a way that maybe we can try and deal with this? Like you say, it comes down to more not necessarily having the number of workers available. It's the fact that the jobs have to still be there, I guess, to be able to put these people to work, or certainly keep people to work, isn't it?
I mean, we need to have a fundamental conversation about what the future of jobs in the United States is going to look like. Mm-hmm. And because we haven't really talked about that enough, that's why we're in this situation. You know, manufacturing jobs are on the decline, and nothing in the world can change that simply because of technology, automation, and increased productivity. And so we really, as a country, need to sit down and say, what will the typical job look like in 10, 20, 50, 100 years, and how do we best kind of go on that path in order to get there the easiest and least painful way possible?
I know that the idea, at least seems from the Trump administration standpoint, is that these are jobs that have left America, that have gone overseas, and obviously that the intent is to bring jobs or to create jobs here in the United States, to bring these businesses back to life in the United States. It's I know, of course, it's been termed as protectionism in some respects. And do you think, is there any chance in some cases, maybe not all, but in some cases, that there may be jobs that are created here in the United States and more specifically here in Indiana that might be able to make up for those jobs that had been done overseas being lost?
Yeah, and so I think we will see a small increase in employment in the steel industry. But again, it's going to be offset by a much larger decrease in employment in, you know, farming and other kind of fields are going to be more negatively impacted by the tariffs. I mean, again, the tariffs have a place. And again, they're primarily used as a threat. You rarely want to really follow through too often. Otherwise, you risk entering a trade war like this. But, you know, a much better solution would be to look into, you know, investing in new technology to become better at what we produce and to find, you know, new jobs and new training for workers that are displaced, to subsidize those industries, maybe like steel that we decide are important enough for us to keep, even if we have to do it at a disadvantage competition abroad. Tariffs, like I said, are a very blunt instrument, and you don't just kind of chuck a bunch of tariffs out there and have it solve everything. They're kind of like a nuclear option, the last thing you want to implement. So once you've tried all of the diplomacy and everything else, still.
So it's not a case where, okay, we've lost the jobs because of the tariffs. Well, okay, we'll set up the factories back here in the United States, and we'll make those widgets here in the country again. Maybe, you know, 100 years ago or 50 years ago, they were made in the United States, and they went overseas in the meantime, and we will bring those jobs back here. But I guess the question comes down to, okay, we might be able to do that, but the technology is going to turn out to be, if it took 100 people to work in a factory, you may only have about 20 people running that factory in the future, right?
Absolutely. And the statistic I like to share is that back in 1990, we produced, or today, I'm sorry, in Indiana, we produced 33% more steel than we did in just 1990, mm-hmm. but we do it with 33% fewer workers. So even if steel production comes back and demand for U.S. steel increases, you're not going to see the return to the high levels of employment we had, and certainly not in the 70s and 80s and earlier, but even to the 1990s, we have a lot more productivity, a lot more automation, a lot more output per worker now. And you may see some small uptick in employment, but they're able to crank up the production quite a bit without employing that many more workers.
Well, Mike, it sounds like this is certainly, to be sure, it's a dynamic story. It's going to continue on. And as things escalate as far as the Trump administration's plans for more tariffs and, in turn, the retaliation that other countries levy on us, we're going to see more of the story come up again, too. Thanks for spending time with us to talk about it today, and we'll be checking back with you again soon.
Great. Thank you a lot, Chris. It's going to be an exciting time.
That's to be sure. We're talking with Indiana University Northwest economist Micah Pollack. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Some Indiana manufacturers are shifting focus from workforce development to upgrading automation. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports that a survey found manufacturers are saying Industry 4.0, digital manufacturing, has arrived in the Hoosier State.
The Indiana Manufacturers Survey found workforce development is not the top concern for some manufacturers. Instead, many are looking to improve facilities, equipment, and technology. Survey co-author Mark Froelich says these responses show the next manufacturing revolution has hit Indiana.
Our perception in the data of this year's study is, I think, many companies are finally beginning to take that step and plunge ahead.
Froelich says as larger companies update technology, smaller manufacturers who supply them will need to reach to keep up.
When your major customers are moving forward into Industry 4.0 and digital manufacturing, you're almost forced to move into.
The survey has been given annually for 12 years. It records responses from manufacturers across the state. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
Time for learning more about a new novel available for readers. As a man who wakes up in an unfamiliar body and is tasked with solving a murder, this week on Shelf Discovery.
Every morning brings a do-over, because this week's discovery ends up trapped in the same deadly day. Thanks for tuning in to this week's Shelf Discovery. I'm Kristen Dreyer Kramer. When you're hitting the beach or hanging out by the pool, there's just nothing like the easygoing entertainment of a cozy mystery or a fun contemporary romance to pass the time. But if you're looking for something deeper and more demanding, there's the twisting mystery of author Stuart Turton's debut, The 7½ Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle. The story begins as a man wakes with no memory of who he is or how he ended up in the woods. After finding his way to Blackheath, the rundown estate where he's apparently staying, he finds himself stuck in a mystery. When he looks in the mirror, he sees Dr. Sebastian Bell. But he's not Dr. Bell. He's Aiden Bishop. And he's destined to relive the same day in the bodies of 8 different men until he's able to solve the murder of Evelyn Hardcastle. Only then can he escape. Now, The 7½ Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle is anything but a fluffy beach read. It's the kind of book that pulls you in and doesn't let go, that makes you wrestle to put the pieces together. There's certainly a lot going on here. Each day, Aiden wakes to start the same day over again, only in a different body. And he regularly comes into contact with himself in a different host. It's all mystifying stuff, which is why it will take you longer to read than the average mystery. But it's well worth the effort. Blackheath is filled with interesting characters whose lives are somehow connected to another murder that took place 19 years ago. And as Aiden interacts with these characters, he finds himself taking on a variety of additional tasks. Each discovery adds a new layer to the story, and each one of Aiden's hosts brings another new personality. And woven together, all of these characters and clues and stories make for a fascinating, albeit head-spinning, whodunit. But is it worth living and reliving the day at Blackheath? On a scale of buy it, borrow it, or don't bother, I say buy it. The 7.5 deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle is a mesmerizing and entirely engrossing novel, perfect for quiet nights curled up by the fire. Well, it looks like we've come to the last page of this week's Shelf Discovery. The 7.5 Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle by Stuart Turton is 388 twisted and tricky pages long and is available from Sourcebooks Landmark. For more information, along with show archives and even more reviews, visit shelfdiscovery.org and nightsandweekends.com. And feel free to send any questions, comments, or recommendations my way at books@shelfdiscovery.org. Until next time, wherever the week may take you, don't forget to bring a book.
Dedicated to helping busy readers wade through the shelves and shelves of options to discover books that are worth their often limited reading time, Shelf Discovery can be heard here Thursdays on Regionally Speaking, here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. And that's as Kristen Dreyer Kramer offers listeners a look inside the pages of a new book. And that's it for Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday for today. Thanks to Dan Carton of the Times of Northwest Indiana and from the Herald Argus and News Dispatch, Kelly Smith, for joining us today. And I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for being with us. But we'll be back with you on Monday.